Gary Jenkins is a former intelligence unit detective with the Kansas City Police Department. Fortunately for all of us, he's not missing. He hosts the Gangland Wire podcast on iTunes. He joins me today to talk about mafia-related disappearances. I'm Ed Densel, and this is Unfound. Before I get too deep into this episode in my interview with Gary Jenkins, I think I need to give all of you an update about this show. I don't ever want it to be a secret how well this show is doing. I know other hosts out there may be very secretive. That's not how I really want to handle things here. First of all, I'm very pleased with how the Facebook discussion group is going. We have 43 members, which I think is pretty good given that the show is only a couple months old. I'll just be honest with you on that. This show continues to be day after day in the top 200 most popular shows on Podomatic, where I upload this show first, and then it, of course, eventually makes its way to iTunes. And for a show to remain in the top 200, even though it's only coming out one day a week, to me, is very, very good, especially given that it's a relatively new show. And all of you are to thank for that, and I deeply appreciate that. And I just want you to know, I gauge the popularity of this show on downloads, not on subscribers or reviews or anything else. Unlike, for example, on iTunes, it mainly bases the popularity of the show on subscribers. That's not how I do it. As long as I see that the show is being downloaded more and more week after week, then I'm happy. That's my criteria. And I don't want to be secretive about that. I want you to know. Being that I do know that I have a lot of new listeners, people who are just finding out about this show recently, I think I need to reiterate what this show is about and the goals of this show, because it's kind of a two-pronged kind of thing we're doing here. On one hand, the way I pick out cases for the show, there's two criteria. One, the case is generally not that well known. I have nothing against necessarily the Mara Murray case or the Jennifer Kessie case or some of these other well-known disappearances of the last, whatever, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. I have nothing against all of them, but I don't know how much new ground can be made in any of those new cases either. My attitude also is that all these other disappearances, they're just as important. All right, so that's why on this show, many of the weeks, you're going to hear about a case you've never heard about before. Second of all, I judge a case on, after I look at the evidence, what I can find out on the internet and elsewhere, can progress be made? Can we, in giving focus to that case, cause some new leads to be generated? Because the way I see all of you is I want you to listen to the show, but I also want you to be soldiers for those people who come on this show. I want you to listen to them. That's why I do interviews with this show. I want you to get to know these people like I've gotten to know these people. So you become emotionally invested. And after the show is done, you go out and you do your own looking around as well. And maybe that way, instead of this person just relying on, you know, the police or their immediate family or on themselves, now they have all of you in the thousands to also help them. That's why I handle the show the way I do. There's the other side of it as well, and I think this particular episode is a symbol of that. I want my listeners to be experts on understanding the entire atmosphere of missing persons in the United States. So that's why not only have I covered cases on this show, but I've had Megan Good on this show to talk about her website and how all that happens. Not only did I talk to Kelly Murphy about the disappearance of her son, Jason Jolkowski, but I talked to her about what it's like to run a missing persons nonprofit group that helps the families of missing people. That's why I talked to Mary Lyle, of course, once again, about her daughter, but I also talked to her about the work she's done. And then in a few weeks from now, I'm going to have on the show Tad DeBias, who is known as the No Body Guy. He is a prosecutor, former prosecutor, a lawyer, who specializes in what are believed to be murder cases where there is no body. I want you to all become familiar with all of that. Today's show is an example of that, where we're not talking about a specific case. We're talking about a certain kind of disappearance, and that, in this case, is the mob-related disappearance. I am convinced, especially after talking to Gary, that we can learn a lot about disappearances in general by focusing on mob disappearances, and I'm going to talk about that after you listen to this interview. Don't think that this whole entire hour is going to be talking about the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa. It's not. We mention it, Gary and I talk about it for a little bit, and we do mention a couple other cases, and there's no doubt that mob stuff is still very popular in the United States. The Godfather movies, over 40 years old, are still popular. Goodfellas, coming out in, 1990, still popular. The Sopranos was rated the number one TV show of all time by Rolling Stone. Obviously, Americans love mob-related stories, but it's more than that. I think that we can learn how to solve regular disappearances by looking into mafia-related disappearances. So I want to teach you about that. I want you to learn about that because, once again, I want my listeners to become very knowledgeable about everything regarding disappearances, not just certain cases that I talk about from week to week, because I think that way, that's how a lot of these cases that haven't been solved for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years are going to get solved by the populace, all of those people who haven't been affected by a disappearance, getting more involved and becoming more knowledgeable. That's one of the reasons this show exists. One more point I'd like to make about mob-related disappearances before we get into the interview, and this is maybe a little bit personal to me, is that what I find compelling about them is that after governments of the world, and this isn't a political show, but we all know that over history, not just 21st century, but 20th century, 19th century, going way back, governments have made large groups of their population simply disappear. No paperwork, march them out into a field, execute these people, and bury them, never to be found again. Well, after governments of the world that have made people disappear, I have to believe that the next large group that has made the most people disappear over history is the mob. So that's one more reason I thought that it would be good to cover them, being that they've become so good at it. And once again, maybe we can all learn something from that as we try to solve these cases. I remind you, you can find me on Twitter. My Twitter name is Unfound Podcast, of course, with the little A with the circle around it. You can email me, unfoundpodcast@gmail.com. You can find this show at Podomatic and iTunes. Please listen, share, and subscribe. And then please join the rest of the group on Facebook, and that is the Unfound discussion page. Please join the conversation. I now give you my interview with Gary Jenkins, host of the show Gangland Wire, which you can find on iTunes. I'm so happy to have on the show Gary Jenkins from Gangland Wire. How are you doing today, Gary?
Doing great, Ed. It's my pleasure to be here.
Great. Gary hosts a show where all they do is talk about mafia issues, mainly Kansas City cases, right? Kansas City mob.
for the most.
Yeah, we started out with almost all Kansas City, but you know, I'm starting to expand out. I've done several Chicago stories, and there's always a connection between Kansas City and Chicago. And I did one on Murder Incorporated back in New York, and I've done a few things outside of the mob, but it's been primarily mafia stuff. I just did a Kansas City serial killer. I haven't got it up yet. I've done two Kansas City serial killers. I've got one up. I had the guys that investigated it. I've got an interview in for the second one and from the guy that investigated it, so I haven't got it up yet.
How'd you get into all this, Gary?
Well, you know, I did that movie, Gangland Wire, which is I worked that investigation as a young detective where we Kansas City mob boss, Nick Savella, really was the guy given the job of overseeing and making sure the skim out of the Las Vegas casinos back in the 70s ran correctly. And if some enforcement action needed to be taken or somebody needed to be talked to or straightened out or some job needed to be given or somebody needed to be told to get out of the business, that was their job in Kansas City. Now, Chicago was the big duck, and most money went to them, but he worked hand in glove. He was kind of like Chicago's enforcement arm for what happened. And this was the movie that this became the movie Casino,
right?
Book by Nicholas Pileggi Casino,
right?
Was so well known. Robert De Niro played the Lefty Rosenthal part, which that was the guy's real name. His name in the movie was H. Rothstein. Joe Pesci played Tony Squattro, and I can't remember the guy's. Nicky Santoro, I think, in the movie. Anyhow, so I was in Kansas City following these guys around while the FBI was wiretapping them, talking about all these events.
And you were a local policeman?
Right. I was with the intelligence unit.
Okay. Okay. And that's how you became familiar with all this?
You know, after I retired, I went to law school, and I started practicing law, and I kind of got a little bit of time on my hands, and I got interested in making documentary films. And I made two about Civil War subjects in the Missouri area, and I'd always wanted to tell this story about our part and the FBI, Kansas City FBI's part, in bringing down the four major Midwest families, Cleveland, Milwaukee, Chicago, and Kansas City, because it all emanated out of Kansas City and the wiretaps that the FBI had going here. I went to the FBI office. I had to file a motion with the Western District Federal Court. Once I filed that motion and asked the court to order them to give up all the evidence, all the exhibits have been placed in evidence on the, what we call the straw man trial. That was the code name of the investigation, the Tropicana and the Stardust skim trials. I was able to go over to the FBI office with a couple of retired FBI agents, and we got all the wiretap, all the audio and the transcripts from that investigation. And on that, I made a documentary movie about that whole story, how the FBI first got into it, how the case developed, and then how they brought it down at the end. So that's kind of the long version of how I got into that.
And I'm going to link to that, by the way. When this show gets posted, I'm going to link to that so the listeners can go and watch it. So how many years?
You can get it for $1.99.
Okay.
For $1.99.
Yeah, that's right.
I quit trying to sell DVDs because, you know, nobody has a DVD player anymore.
No.
Well,
I'm still stuck in the 90s, so I do. Gary,
right,
I do.
If I haven't sent you a DVD, give me your address. We'll get off of here and I'll send you one.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. So how many years would you say that you dealt with the mob and the mafia in your between your police experience and your law experience? How many years?
Oh, I spent 13. I had my 25 years on the police department. I spent 13 investigating the Kansas City mob and other professional criminals that were associates directly. And really, as a lawyer, I really don't do much criminal law, and by the time I became a lawyer, the mob was so far down after they took them off in the straw man case that there's really not much law to be practiced there.
Right.
So I'd say really like 13, 14 years, and then I'm back into it now with the podcast and blog and And I have people contact me all the time about things that are going on, and do I know about this? Am I interested in talking about that?
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm still into it in a way because of the podcast and the blog. I've written about it quite a little bit too on my website.
All right. Well, as you know, this is a show about disappearances, and what we're going to mainly talk about is mob disappearances, because as I've portrayed before this interview played, is that after governments like mainly socialist communist governments like the Soviet Union and China and North Korea make people disappear, probably the next organized, to forgive the pun, or next organized group that makes people disappear, I think, is probably the mob. And so you ran into probably a lot of disappearances maybe in those 13, 14 years. And we're going to talk about a couple cases here in a moment. But did you see a lot of that in your 13 years where you'd be following somebody and all of a sudden they'd just kind of drop off the map? Was that a common occurrence in Kansas City?
Well, only if I lost them.
Okay.
I'd find them later.
Yeah. Okay. But what I mean is the mob.
The way I heard that's like, well, yeah, I lost a lot of people.
Okay. But the mob made people disappear.
They did once in a while. Here's was my experience. It didn't happen a lot in Kansas City.
Okay.
It's happened in other cities, and it depends on whether they want to send a message. Mostly, if the La Cosa Nostra organized crime, a La Cosa Nostra style organized crime family kills somebody, it's a precise, thought out judgment call. It's not just willy nilly, I'm mad at this guy. There has to be a good reason for it, mainly because, as they found to their dismay in the end, that it brings down a lot of heat.
Yeah.
Now, in Kansas City, just before, one of the reasons that the FBI really brought so much pressure to bear on the local family, what we call the Savella family, was because there was this series of murders in which the bodies were all found in the car.
Wow.
Which was a message.
Yeah.
There was a series of them. And for example, Tiger Cardarella, he screwed up a bunch of money. He was a made guy and had, you know, he'd done his own murder that he'd messed up back in the early 60s. Except he got the fix in, so he got off on a not guilty plea. But he was an older, like 55, 60-year-old guy. He got into cocaine and young girls and kind of went nuts and screwed up a big connection they had. He had record shops, and he was selling stolen records.
Mm-hmm.
He was getting cash money for concert tickets, and he ran off. Just like about $30,000 of it disappeared. About that guy starts complaining, pulls his ticket business out of Tiger's record stores, which was a huge, you know, financial loss. And record stores were already going down; they just closed up.
Right.
And that source of money dried up for the mob, and he was also untrustworthy because they knew he was becoming a coke addict. He was found dead in the trunk, or no, I think it was in the back seat of his car, and they cut his pockets. So mm-hmm. you could see that, you know, he'd been messing with money. That mm-hmm. was a signal that was sent out there. And they usually sent a signal. Now, we had a couple cases, and there's probably more than one, so some periphery people that may have disappeared. But there was a couple of them where I think there was a reason they wanted them to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And
how is that decision made? I mean, how?
Thought out reason decision
before
they get off somebody.
Yeah, how do they come to that decision? Like, this guy we're going to leave to send a message, but this guy over here, we just need to make him disappear. He did the exact same thing, but we're going to make him disappear.
Well, maybe with some people, they don't really need to send a message.
Right.
And with some people, it's helpful to make them disappear because it cuts down on the investigation quite a little bit.
Yeah, right.
That's the main reason to make somebody disappear, because it cuts way back on the investigation. Just to get the police and even the FBI involved at the beginning of it when it first happened is hard, because it, you know, your first thought is, oh, they just went off to Vegas, or they just are off on a tube, or they're hiding out for some other reason. And then the mob, their first thought is when somebody disappears, the other mobsters, their first thought is, well, they went to the witness protection program and nobody gets nervous.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that a little later, maybe when we get into like the fictionalization of mob. But before we get into these two cases that you sent me that I've looked over, probably the case that virtually every American knows about as far as the mob and the disappearance is Jimmy Hoffa. I don't want to really get into the facts and specifics of that. They had a problem with him. Why would that have been possibly a case where they made him disappear instead of murdering him? What in your insight into it, your experience?
You know, I would say that that was one where they wanted to inhibit any investigation because they knew. They knew that there would the investigation would be intense. They
right.
would be shaking the bushes for informants to try to find out.
Right.
And you know, they knew that there was there were some witnesses who saw him get in the car. They
mm-hmm.
could not avoid that. They could not get him totally isolated. The way the mob works is they really would like to be able to meet up with you. If I wanted to kill you, as I'm a mob guy, I'll get you to meet me someplace where nobody really sees us get together,
right.
even at the beginning. That way, I'm not the last person seen alive with you. And so they knew that they could not get him isolated. So they met him in a public place at that. That was at Matthew Fox Restaurant, I think.
Right, I remember that.
Was it in the Detroit area? I can't remember exactly where
mm-hmm.
it was. But anyhow, they met him in a public place in a parking lot, and there were people that saw him get in a car, describe the car, and it drove off. And that last time he was seen alive. And so I think probably it takes a while for people to get into that investigation. And then even when you get into it, it's really hard to convict somebody if you don't have a body.
That's right.
I'm surprised they don't make them all disappear just for that reason. Especially with the modern day, probably more disappeared now than maybe in the past. They don't really kill that many people now.
Mm-hmm. Because of DNA and DNA.
DNA and all that. It's, you know, you'd have to wear one of those laboratory suits to one of those white hazmat suits and
right.
burn it in order to not leave any evidence anymore.
Right.
If you leave a body around to process.
It's funny you mentioned that because on an upcoming episode, I'm planning to have a well-known lawyer who specializes in no-body cases, where there's no body and trying to convict somebody. So I will let you know when that episode is going to play.
Yeah,
so, that'll be good. Let's move to these two cases that you sent me, the case of Sal Manzo and Jimmy Tolles. And let's just go one by the other, and we'll talk about a little bit of the facts and maybe why these two guys, the mob, chose to make them both disappear. Let's start with Sal.
Sal Manzo was he was not a made guy. He was a kind of a periphery guy, but he grew up with everybody. He grew up in the neighborhood with everybody, and he had been involved in helping run the book, and when they wanted to, before we had gambling casinos, we got a state law passed to have bingo games.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a little bit of money that you can make in a bingo game. The problem was the state statute says you had to have a nonprofit that was a beneficiary of that, and then you could only pay the professional staff a reasonable amount of money. And they had an investigative arm, the state did, to audit those books. And so what they did is and Sal Manzo ran this little operation. He got some people to form nonprofits who were just straws.
And straw men.
And they get that straw man deal on how to get a square John looking guy to run something for them while they siphon the money out through him. And so he was running that, and that. They were under intense investigation for that. He was helping to run a book at the time. And at the same time, it was like he had a lot going. And he also got himself involved with an ATF, undercover ATF agent, unknowingly, and bought a load of, I believe it was blue jeans. Somebody stole a whole trailer load of clothing. I think it was blue jeans.
Wow.
And he was brokering that deal, and he liked this guy so well, he even brought him into the local social club that they have. Like you've heard of the Ravenite Social Club with John Gotti, or the Bergen Fish and Hunt Club, or Fish and Game Club with Gotti, and some of those other little social clubs. Well, we had the Northview Social Club, or the Columbus Park Social Club. They changed names a couple of times. I think we ended up at Columbus Park. But he brought him in there, and, you know, he was able to sit in there and, you know, drink some espresso and, you know, chat people up. And
this undercover, like this undercover ATF agent.
Undercover ATF, yeah.
Okay,
And so that all had to come down because they took that whole sting down. It was not designed to, and it was an operation not designed to last forever. And I think the ATF probably decided that this agent couldn't stay, it couldn't leave him in undercover with the mob at the time. I don't know the reason he went into it. More than likely, they were not accepting men because Kansas City is a small town. It would be impossible, I think almost impossible, for anybody, any law enforcement person, to ever worm their way in with the Kansas City family. So they took it all down, and then it came out. And Sal Manzo, it was, you know, they were getting ready to indict him, or they had indicted him. He knew that was coming down. So he had a ton of stuff coming down on him. Now, who knows exactly why? Because, you know, if two people can keep to have a secret and one of them is dead, then you don't ever learn that secret. Well, that's kind of how they are. So who knows really why? He was last seen with, I believe it was Vince Abbott. Just saw him standing on the street by Memphis' car talking. Somebody just drove by and happened to see him and thought, oh, look at, you know, just, you didn't think he'd think about it at the time, and he was never seen again.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think his family was really upset about this. I think they wanted him to disappear for a variety of reasons. One of them is he was, you know, he was under indictment. He was, you know, they knew there'd be an intense investigation on this. Maybe for family reasons, the family was taken into consideration because he had an extended family in Kansas City. This is a small town, and these people all know each other, and they're married to each other's cousins and in-laws and went to school together, and so they know each other.
Mm-hmm.
I got a retired policeman I played golf with, and I'll start talking and you know, figure out, he's like, you know, all these different, you know, periphery mob characters. He ends up going to the weddings with them all the time.
Right. It's like 6 degrees of separation. This person knows this person, this person.
He knows them all, you know. And I think his son married the nephew of a guy that was a victim of a hit, one of the last ones we had. He was a gambler. He got hit in his driveway. But anyhow, that's how small Kansas City is. So, you know, his family really wanted to know, and it was almost like...
Sal's family wanted to know.
Yeah, they wanted to know. They still want to know. I even had an inquiry recently. I was doing a question and answer session when I was showing my movie, and somebody approached me afterwards and said, yeah, I've got... Sal Manzo's got some family up in, I believe it was Minneapolis, and they're still wondering. They knew I was going to come see this movie, and you were going to be there, and they wanted me to ask you if there's any possibility that anybody could figure out, you know, find his body. And so at the end of the Manzo deal, for whatever reason, they wanted to disappear, partly, I think, mainly to hinder and delay any investigation.
Yeah.
They got a little bit weak, so they did the next best thing. They had some, there was a police detective that lived over in the neighborhood and knew everybody. Like I said, it's a small town, and gone to school with some of the guys, and somebody gave him an anonymous phone call and said, you know, for Sal Manzo, you might want to go check at this particular trash can up on St. John and Belmont.
Mm-hmm.
So he knew where that was. It wasn't about 10 blocks from his house. He drove over there and he found all Sal's clothes in that trash can.
My.
Which was the signal they sent that, yeah, Sal's gone, Sal's dead, you know, just relax. You know, that's the best we're going to do. So, and that investigation went nowhere.
What year was that? Well, that was in Kansas City, and what year was that?
I want to say that was 1980, probably.
Oh, okay, it's been a while then. Okay.
Yeah, it's been a while.
All right.
Yeah, we haven't had any mob activity in Kansas City much to speak of.
Okay. So that was for the listeners. them with those clothes in the trash can. I mean, if everybody's seen The Godfather, that's kind of like when that they send that package with that fish saying Luca Brasi sleeps with the fishes. Yeah. Kind of the same thing.
Yeah, they're big old messages, just like the pockets. It's like finding the clothes in the trash can. In my opinion, that message, because his family was upset about the missing body, was because they were just letting him know that he ain't never coming back and he's buried somewhere.
Do you think that Sal, maybe we can talk about this after the next case as well, do these people, these guys usually, who end up disappearing, do they know it's coming? I mean, in Sal's case, he knows that he's gotten in trouble. He knows that, you know, there's an indictment coming down. He knows this. He has to suspect that something bad could happen. I mean, he knows the mob. Do you think these people see the stuff coming?
You know, some of them do, some of them don't. It just depends on the personality and how different personalities have different awareness of what's going on around him. He might have been such an ego. I never knew him personally. Really never knew much about him. He was a pretty periphery character. But, you know, he may have had such an ego that he didn't think anybody ever do anything to him, or he may have had some idea, but, you know, maybe he liked to drink. So, you know, if somebody invited him out that he thought he could trust, because that's how they do it. They find somebody you trust.
Okay.
And get you out alone somewhere, and then that's when they do you. Very seldom, and if you're so suspicious, then they'll hit you in a public place, which doesn't happen very often. We've had a few, but those people that they hit in a public place were already, there'd been maybe even a botched effort. One of them, there was a botched effort with the bomb. The blasting cap went off in the guy's hand that was trying to plant the bomb because they found little bits and pieces of his hand all over the back seat. But it wasn't a big enough explosion that was an actual bomb. So, you know, they know. But, you know, Sal, he may or may not have known. It just depends on the personality.
All right, now we got the next one, Jimmy Tolles. Tell us about Jimmy Tolles and what happened to him. And what year was this? Did this happen?
Let's see. That was probably 80, when I get promoted, 84. That was probably 83.
Okay, and this was also in Kansas City.
Yeah, in Kansas City. Jimmy Tolles was a professional criminal, grew up over in what we call the North End or Little Italy with all the guys. He was not Italian, of course. You can tell by his name.
I'm not sure.
He might have half Italian. A lot of these guys sometimes their mother will be Italian. But anyhow, he grew up over there and he'd been a thief from day one. I found a really old newspaper clipping where he was at 18 years old, he's with a guy named Johnny Joe Shortino, who ends up being a bookmaker later on in life and a made guy. They get caught with a whole trunkload of stolen suits. They broke into the back of a shopping mall men's clothing store and stole a whole pile of suits. You know, so he started out early as a professional thief doing kind of higher-end burglaries and sweating like a little neighborhood kid breaking in neighbors' houses for TV. This was a professional operation, stealing suits for resale.
Okay.
So he goes on forward, and Jimmy Tolles becomes an expert locksmith. His thing was, and he continues to, he's very valuable to these mob guys now because he becomes a really good thief. He does, and he liked one thing he was noted for, they caught him with, he, and the guys had seen him staking out golf courses, and he would sit at the golf course parking lot and try to pick out cars that might have a really good set of clubs in the trunk.
Wow.
And he was stealing golf clubs selling the better sets of used golf clubs to different people around him. But he graduated on into jewelry theft. Now there's a little crew of guys here, John Crecio and Johnny Joe Palin, I think Carl Spiro might have done some of that. But Johnny Joe Palin, John Crecio, and Vince Abbott, they had a little group that they would find all over the United States, really, but especially the Midwest. They got some intelligence into jewelry salesmen, kind of a higher-end jewelry salesman. Mm-hmm. At that point in time, I don't know if they're still doing this, but these guys would come out with $100,000 worth of jewelry in the trunk of their car in display cases and then call on jewelry stores.
Yeah.
And so they would follow them around and try to get patterns on them. Now, once in a great while, they might stick a gun in their face, but they didn't really like to do that because they didn't have to if you could steal it out of their car.
Yeah.
It's the armed robbery, the penalties are a whole lot more for armed robbery than they are for just breaking into your car.
So even the mob sometimes tries to avoid violence, right? Even once in a while they try to get around it. Okay. Okay, that's good to know.
The good, smart criminals always try to avoid violence.
Okay.
The successful criminals will always try to avoid violence. I'd say in the La Cosa Nostra Mafia, for the most part, they try to avoid violence. Now, sometimes they hire people who don't really care much about it. Doesn't look like it, but the smart guys will try to avoid violence. And so Jimmy Tolles was part of their deal because he could get in the cars. He could go into a car. He had master keys and he could pick in and he was a master locksmith. Mm-hmm. So they would follow the jewelry salesman around and then try to catch him, get a pattern on him and maybe see where he ate and when he was out calling on stores and he came to town and rented a car and then stay in a motel and then they try to follow him and you know there's a regular like a police operation really a surveillance operation on these jewelry salesmen. Remember one time some of our guys in the intelligence unit caught him trailing the guy down on the little shopping area with all the plaza going from you know they saw him hanging around out in front of the jewelry store and then this guy came out with a display case. And all three of them, Johnny Joe Clea and Vince Abbott, can't remember the third one, maybe I don't remember if Jimmy Tolles was one of them or not, they like go on point and they drift along and watch and see where this guy goes as he goes to another jewelry store. So they, I think they called in uniform officers and had them like grab one of them up and mess with him a little bit. But that's how they operated. So they made a really nice score.
Wow.
These three guys with Jimmy Tolles. Joe Bailey had brought around along another guy named Tommy Sorrentino because he was really, he could run really fast. Somebody started chasing him. They could give him the
chance. Everybody has their skill, right?
Yeah, he had the skill. Tolles could break you. Johnny Joe Kalia was a tough guy. And I think that was probably the brain. And so they made John Caricio was part of this too. He was a big sack. I don't know. He was probably the brains actually.
What happened to Jimmy Tolles? What happened to him?
Jimmy Tolles, what happened, first of all, they caught Caricio and I think Abbott throwing away the empty contained the display boxes, display cases.
Wow.
And some street policeman just stumbled onto them, and they were, like, littering out there. So he got out and confronted them, and they got their names, and they went on. Then he picked up this stuff, and he realized, you know, there was something more to this. And so they connected him up to later the same day of the theft, they connected these two guys up. So, you know, informants and intelligence let the FBI, it was an interstate theft from interstate shipment, so the Bureau got onto it, and they knew who the whole crew was by then, and they knew Jimmy Tolles was part of, so they were putting an immense amount of heat on him. Well, in the meantime, there's a Johnson County detective, John Schofield, he's helping them. They go to him because Tolles lives over by where his jurisdiction is, and so he has an informant who knows Tolles. He sends the informant in, and the informant comes back out. She bought a little marijuana in, you know, just one of these old. He wasn't a major marijuana dealer. He was, you know, he's kind of one of these guys. If I got something, you want to buy something, I'll sell it to you. So she buys a little marijuana from him. And this was important enough that they wanted to get into his house and search it. So they got a search warrant based on that. And they got a little more evidence on this jewelry theft thing. So he had a heat coming down him as they connected him up to this jewelry theft. And about, I don't know, sometime shortly after that search warrant went down there, it's going to be appealed. The probable cause on it was appealed. and things are moving kind of slowly but surely, and those guys feel like Jimmy Tolles is probably a weak link here.
Yeah. And he's going to talk.
Yeah, he's going to talk. And one of them, I think, was Vince Abbott, picked him up, and that's the last time Jimmy Tolles was ever seen. And nobody, he was not, a close, he had no close family members from the neighborhood. He was not connected in any manner. He was simply a, what we call a peckerwood or a non-Italian associate. And so they, unless they told his girlfriend, she's still around, it looks to me like, but I doubt she did. They did. And so that, that's a way to just cut it off right there. And he's the kind of guy that at first, your local police, his girlfriend would go to the local jurisdiction, and when she tells them a little bit about him and his lifestyle, and they'll say, well, he's gone. And there won't be much, and really not much you can do. The bureau will start shaking informant streets a little bit, but these aren't the kind of things that people go out and talk about.
Right. Sounds to me like in Jimmy Toll's case, is he was a little sloppy. I mean, these guys, getting rid of these cases. I mean, you could do that a dozen different ways, but you do it in a way that a cop notices what you're doing. And then the marijuana seems like he just wasn't watching his business close enough.
I think he had outlived his usefulness.
Right.
To them and became more of a liability than an asset.
Right. We'll find another locksmith.
Yeah. Plus, he wasn't even Italian, so he was really expendable.
And once again, probably a guy who probably didn't see it coming. I mean, No,
I don't think he saw it coming at all. I doubt if he saw it coming at all. He's the kind of guy that maybe would have been making excuses. But see, they're smart, man. They're smart. You know your shit's weak, and you come around me, and I say, don't worry. I just did a podcast on a hit out in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. I mean, out now in Los Angeles. And these two guys knew they were in trouble. They had robbed some, in the 50s, some connected bookmakers. And a made guy calls them up and says, you guys, you're going to pay this money back. And they're going, we don't have the money. We'll try to get it. And he said, I got a really nice score. I'm going to set you up to do this really nice score, and then you can pay us back with that. Mm-hmm. So, them being the egomaniacs that they were, said, oh, yeah. So, and this was reported by Jimmy the Weasel Fradiano in the book he wrote about his life after he came in the witness protection program. And that's how he set him up and got him a loan, and where he could be in the back seat, behind them in a secluded place, and then popped them both in the back of the head and left them there in the street. So that's how they do it.
Yeah.
They probably came to Jimmy Tolles and said, you're a piece of work, man, but, help us out with this other score here. We got another score here. Let's go do this.
Yeah.
And
that's when they took care of him.
Agreed, too. There's a lot of ways. They know how to play on you, man.
Right. Now let's compare this, because I think for most people, 99% of what they know about the mafia and the mob is probably what they've seen on TV and what they've seen in movies. For example, once again, we've already mentioned The Godfather. We've mentioned Casino. There's, of course, The Sopranos, which is probably the most recent within the last 15 years. It's still in a lot of people's memory, and I still watch reruns of it. How accurate are disappearances in those types of shows in contrast to what really happens in real life? I'll give you an example. In The Sopranos, of course, Big Pussy is discovered to be an informant. They take him out in that boat. I'm hoping I'm not giving this away for anybody that hasn't seen it yet. But but they shoot him, they put him in the bag, and they dump him into the water. And then afterwards, his wife thinks that he went into the witness protection program or something like that. Is that really what these families end up thinking? Now, he was a made guy in that show, unlike these two guys we talked about. Is that really what families think that they – or do they know kind of that – their family member, their father, their husband got whacked?
Well, it's human nature being what it is, and these professional criminals being multidimensional characters. We see, as I said earlier, we see one part of them publicly. The law enforcement sees the evidence of, and some of their victims see one part of them, but their family sees a whole other part.
Yeah.
Particularly these professional criminals that have grown up in that lifestyle. So the family many times will, you know, they may be suspicious, but they also know that they're helpless, and so they may cling on to that. It's what that whole thing is, and I know I've seen it around here that, you know, first thing anybody says, oh, they went in the witness protection program.
Yeah.
Many people in that subculture, they're so paranoid, and they're paranoid about the government and the FBI, and they think they've got a lot more power in what they do. Don't realize all the legal hoops that that people in law enforcement have to jump through and do jump through. Why, they want to believe that. They want to believe that. That's the thing about the Sopranos. Every one of those disappearances that they did, they did that Richie Aprile where Tony Soprano's sister killed her boyfriend. And they just start telling everybody he must be in the witness protection program. And he's the kind of guy nobody really liked him anyhow, kind of like Sal Manzo. Nobody, people didn't like him either. It was on the street. So, you know, everybody was getting ready to buy into that. Oh, yeah, he went to the witness protection program. Same way with Maltasano's wife. I can't remember her name. Chris's wife, when they killed her.
Yes, yes.
Well, she just ran. You know, she was a drug addict anyhow. She just ran off. She ran off with another guy, and she's staying somewhere. And you notice the families really, they were suspicious, but they really just wanted to buy into that story. It's kind of safe space for everybody. You don't have to confront anybody in your little world. Because that Sopranos world, a little bit like Kansas City. All those people knew each other. They knew each other's families. They'd been to each other's houses. They'd been to weddings and funerals and were married in and around each other. So it reminded me a lot of Kansas City fans. I really laugh when they start digging that one that I can't remember who the guy was. They were digging somebody up out of a basement of a house. Apparently somebody broke and somebody was involved in the murder, and they buried the guy in the basement of this house. Now they poured concrete over him or something, and Tony was sweating. He was sweating like crazy, and then in the end they said the guy just he gave up the murder, but he didn't give up Tony Soprano. So
I remember that.
Yeah. I can imagine that would, you know, and that to me, that stuff all rings really true. They've got some pretty good technical advisors, I'd say, on the Sopranos.
And
as far as getting it real.
And as far as Big Pussy, is it also true when, like, a guy disappears like that, they have to whack him, but then the family, like in Big Pussy's case, Tony financially continued to help his wife out, and she went through some rough times, and I remember him banging her the taillight on her car because she was spending too much money. Is that also true, that if they make somebody disappear like that, that they then feel like they have to financially support the wife or the family? Does that go on?
You know, I've not had any direct experience with that, but they do. For example, if you're connected in close enough and you go to jail, your wife will get a little bit of something. Not as much as they would like everybody to believe, but more than likely your family will be given somebody will make sure they got a job, and they may be given some envelopes of cash. I know during the skim trials and one of the, or not during the skim trials, but during the skim investigation, one of the, Nick Savella's our boss. His nephew, Tony Ripe, is kind of one of the soldiers, shall we speak. He wasn't really a capo or a captain or anything. But he had his own little pieces of action going, and he was in the joint. And his wife was given an envelope of money, and she called her brother, Tuffy DeLuna, who was the underboss, and we got to take the bid. And she's worrying around about she lost this envelope of money, and she said she can't remember where she put it. It's like a supreme scene out of The Sopranos.
Right.
Something like that happened. Or they're just worrying around, and he's questioning about where it could be and what she should do and whether she should tell Nick or not. And she didn't want to get in trouble.
That's, yeah.
So yeah, that's. They were getting envelopes of cash to Las Vegas, and he was giving some of it to his nephew's wife. Even though the nephew didn't have anything to do with the action, he was in joint. He'd gone to joint for some other an old bookmaking charge.
I'd like to stay in the fiction world just a little bit and contrast to the world, real world a little bit more, and then we'll get back to the real world exclusively. Regarding how they make people disappear in the mob, once again, getting the Sopranos, and well, let's go to Goodfellas for a second. What happens, for example, when happening in Goodfellas, when Joe Pesci's character assaulted that maid guy, and he shouldn't have done that, and you know, and the other guys have to like cover it up, and of course they put him in one spot, and then they had to move him. Is that big trouble? I mean, if you mistakenly make a maid man disappear, that's big trouble, right?
Oh God, yeah, you kill a maid guy. That's the Sopranos got that one right too. They'll mention that every once in a while. You can't do anything. He's a maid guy.
Right.
Don't forget, he's a maid guy. Yeah, you do not. If you're in that world, you don't do something to a maid guy. Actually, if you're in that world, even if you're just an associate, you're not a maid guy, but you are part of a crew, a professional thief, part of somebody's crew. You don't go out and do that kind of a crime, a murder particularly, at all, without making sure it's been cleared, because they like to control that kind of stuff. And that's the kind of shit that brings down heat. That's the kind of stuff that somebody gets that's why one of the main reasons they don't want you dealing dope, because the sentences are so draconian that, you know, you can't trust somebody that's looking at a 50 or 35 year sentence or a life sentence or the death penalty. You cannot trust somebody that's looking at that.
Right.
Unless they're like, you know, their brother or your brother-in-law or something.
But you have to get the okay. I mean, you see in so many of these movies and TV shows, if you want to make a whack somebody or make somebody disappear, that has to be a sit down, and you have to agree with it, and you know these things have to be done.
Boss has to give his approval, and they, you know, give him some kind of reason and give him his approval. Like John Gotti had Paul Castellano killed. He was in trouble with that, but he was able to negotiate his way out of that. For what I have to go back and look at that.
Okay.
But for some way, somehow he negotiated his way out of that.
One more thing in the fiction world before we get back into the real world. And the way they dispose of these people, you hear about acid, of course, in The Sopranos, some other movies, there's like the butcher shop that they use to cut people up. That stuff's real, isn't it? That's how they really make these people disappear.
Yeah, probably. I'm kind of operating under a weakness here because I don't know of, I've never been part of
anything like that. Okay, I understand. I understand, Gary. I understand.
Like here in Kansas City, you know, they've got a butcher shop. We had a guy that they found his trunk, and the Savellas had a butcher shop back then, and and actually this guy was part of another little crew that had robbed that. The guy that ran the butcher shop, the meat market, the meat locker, was a gambler too, and they robbed him of $10,000 of Savellas money. And this guy, Johnny Brocato, who was connected to the crew that did that, I don't think he wasn't involved as a one-man show, but he was connected to the crew that did it. He shows up dead in his trunk, and the contents of his, and he's been tortured with like light cigarette lit. With cigarettes on his body and burns like that on all over his body, and his contents of his stomach are still frozen, and it wasn't that cold outside. So you put two and two together, and you come up with, you know, here this upstart faction of the local mob robs a meat locker owner of $10,000 of his bookmaking money, and then one of his compadres then is tortured to find out what's going on, and his whole body is frozen, and then they throw him in the. He was another, like, he was a local Italian guy, and they called his brother and said, you might, you know, they knew they were looking for the body, so somebody called his brother and said, go up to the airport and look at the parking lot for his car, you'll find it.
Wow. Okay. Let's get back to the real world. How often, and this is how you and I originally started talking, this is a topic that we covered the first time we ever talked. Civilians, people who aren't in the mob, but maybe the mob makes one of them disappear if they've been a witness to something or something like that. Of course, maybe the case that maybe the listeners are most familiar with is John Gotti made his neighbor disappear because his neighbor's name was John Favara, who he ran into John Gotti's son and killed him. And I guess John Gotti never forgave him for that. And at some point in the near future after that, John Favara disappeared. Regular guy, it was an accident, and still John Gotti made this, the rumor is, made this guy disappear because of what he did. Is there a lot of stories about just regular people being made to disappear due to the mob, like because they saw something? Does that happen very often?
You know, I have never heard of that. That was there. I've read about that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Gotti had a personal stake in that deal.
Of course, so of course.
It's
of
a
course.
Little bit different sort of thing. He wasn't just a witness. Now, in my experience, you know, they may try to buy a witness off, but it's if it's a real case, a real solid case, and this witness is going to be able to do them, and it's going to be a federal case more than likely, not a state case.
Mm-hmm.
It brings down too much heat, in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the FBI will call in people from all over the United States and triple and quadruple their efforts to mm-hmm. solve that and to continue to make that case, whatever it was, without that witness. And usually there's never one person which everything depends on anyhow. It's usually a multi, you know, level, more than one witness, maybe somebody that's turned witness, goes into the witness protection program, wiretaps, you know, search warrants that have come up with collaborating evidence. So it's most cases never really hinge on one particular person.
Okay.
In my experience. So, and it's, you know, it does not pay to kill off the witness.
It sounds like the police and the FBI, they'll let the mafia, you know, make their own people disappear. And of course, they'll maybe investigated or something like that. But they get serious if they start bringing in outside people. If outside civilians who have nothing to do with the mob or, you know, hurt or murdered because of that, that's when the FBI gets serious, it sounds like.
It's obstruction of justice. That just,
yeah.
You know, that raises all the stakes. If it's one mob killer, another mob guy, you want to solve it, but it's not the kind of thing that the FBI will call, you know, 20 agents in for temporary duty from Chicago and Denver and, mm-hmm. you know, and Dallas or whatever.
Right.
You just have to, you know, figure your resources and what's important and what isn't. And, you know, usually don't have a chance to say if it's another mob guy, anyhow, you don't have a chance in hell of solving it, more than likely.
Is one more thing, because we mentioned this right at the beginning, witness protection. And, you know, when, you know, changing idea, you know, IDs, your identity, like the guy Henry Hill, who was in Goodfellas, and they sent him to Arizona. That doesn't happen as much as people think, does it? I mean, it happens, but most of these people who have disappeared in the mob is because they're dead. Your suspicion,
right.
Well, your experience, I know you weren't in the mob, but your experience working with this, your belief is most...
Yeah, kind of the deal is, if you're offered witness protection, then you're offered it in exchange for something,
yeah.
Not just to help you hide out, and so that exchange is going to be for testimony.
Yeah.
And so then the person is going to come back up at a trial and testify and then disappear back into the witness protection program. That's every case I've ever read of about
mm-hmm.
a witness, somebody well-known going into witness protection program, and I had any experience with it all, direct
mm-hmm.
experience, well, that's the deal. You know, they only give you witness protection if you're going to then testify against somebody.
Right.
If you're just an informant, you know, they might, you're not going to go into witness protection. They might help you move across country or something,
mm-hmm.
but you're not going to go into witness protection unless there's a court case involved mm-hmm. in which you testify. So everybody knows you've got to pop back up and testify,
okay.
Which is an interesting thing because the mob is not as powerful as they used to be, or they're reaching
mm-hmm.
along because we've got old Frank Collada out there in Las Vegas who went in the witness protection program for a while, and he's going to testify against Tony Sparatro and the rest of the heads of the Chicago mob. But And he's running a Las Vegas tour now. So if you want to take a
yes, tour, I recognize the I recognize the name.
Lobster.
Yeah, I recognize the name. I used to live there. I recognize the name. Yeah, I do. You know, and that's
Frank Galata's mob tour.
Yep, I remember the mob tour. Yes, I do remember that. Let's wrap it up this way. And being that you just brought it up, I think that this is a good way to end our interview. What has happened to the mob? What has happened to it since it's, you know, it seems like its influence, its power and all of this thing is greatly diminished, let's say, since the 1950s into the 60s, 70s. What changed?
You know, it really started with, we have to take a little bit of credit here in Kansas City. It started with that investigation because one of the bigger things that came out of that investigation.
Please remind the listeners what investigation that was, please.
No, that was the investigation into skimming from Las Vegas casinos.
Okay.
If you've seen the movie Casino,
right.
You've seen something about it.
Okay, yes.
That was the four Midwest families, and they conspired with people, four different highly placed Teamsters union officials to influence loans to be made to a guy, and one in particular, $62 million loan to a guy named Alan Glick, who bought four casinos, and then he was kicking back as more than $100,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And they owned the Teamsters Union. Now, that's the International Teamsters Union, and they don't have much outside the United States, but they owned the Teamsters Union, controlled all the trucking in the United States. They had huge political power. They had a ton of money you could, and so if you have that, if you can tap into that, then you can and have control over the Teamsters. The Teamsters then will, make donations to politicians. And help people get elected. Politicians, up until Ronald Reagan, basically in the 80s, all the successful politicians curried the favor of somebody like the Teamsters and the different labor unions. And so, you could make political contact, you could influence politicians, you could influence a lot of things. You had this whole, billion-dollar bank that you could, then had the power to get people to loan money out of it to somebody and then get kicked back some money. So, and get all this money kicked back, and which enables you cash money. You can't buy off a local judge or a politician or a city councilman with a check.
No.
But you can buy them off when you got $100,000 in cash coming in every couple of weeks. So you can slip them 10 here and 20 there, and so that was kind of that. And when they started losing, when they lost the Teamsters out of that Labor Department, because that was all exposed with the wiretaps, they took down Jackie Presser in Cleveland and Roy Lee Williams in Kansas City and a guy named Frank Rainey in Milwaukee and Alan Dorfman, and now actually Alan Dorfman got killed as a result of all this in Chicago. In a very public way, he did not disappear.
Yeah, I recognize the name.
They lost the influence over the Teamsters Union. Government put it under trusteeship and then started bringing it back and monitored the elections and made sure that the mob didn't get their hands back into it. So that took that's a huge amount of money out of those four families. And imagine it had a lot of echoes back east, where they started losing. There's so much emphasis then put on labor unions and mob influence over labor unions.
Yeah.
When you start taking that away, then you start taking away political power. They're already losing political power. Society changed, where it wasn't the local politician wasn't quite so hand in glove with the local mob guy and the local political kingmaker, or Richard Daley in Chicago. Goes all the way back to Tammany Hall in New York and Pendergast in Kansas City and Fitzgerald in Boston. And so, modern times, they lost that, and politicians changed. And now you got to pay off the Tea Party in order to get a politician in your pocket, it looks to me like. It's just almost hard to do. It's almost impossible to do to get a politician in your pocket anymore.
Yeah.
And judges all changed. When I first came on the police department, there were still two or three holdovers that were owned by the mob. And in 1970, they died off and retired, you know, by 74, 75. But I remember the names. And they went clear back to the 30s as young lawyers and, you know, first got appointed to the bench, you know, maybe during the war or something. And,
wow.
And we're still sitting on the bench. So, you know, they just lost all that by the 80s. And lost these streams of money. And it's just more, you know, RICO, the more sophisticated enforcement with wiretaps and bugs and RICO law that was passed in the 70s.
And they got a lot more competition, too. I mean, the Russians came in, the Cubans came in, the Mexican mafia came in and all this. A lot of competition, too.
Yeah, and they didn't want to go into the drug game. And the money, the cash money was in the drug game, and they didn't really want to do that.
Right.
And then really, I think they just, you know, outlived their time. There's still a few people involved. But as I say, like, I've got one local lawyer who was in my movie. His dad was Tiger Carterella, who was a victim of a hit, had his pockets cut. So I got him in my movie, and kind of offered, we don't really go into this movie, but off the side, he said, you know, what's happened? He said, guys like my dad and these older guys, you know, that's what they grew up with. That's how they became entrepreneurs, and, you know, they made money, and that's what they knew. But now their kids, most of them, they didn't really want that for us, and, you know, we went to law school like this guy did.
Yeah.
Went to medical school, and they, you know, started legitimate businesses, and so it just, you know, it just changed, and so it's just not, you know, it lost a lot of its romance, except for, you know, like The Sopranos. It still had its romance. That's what's interesting.
Yeah.
We still find it somewhat romantic.
We do.
The idea that there's some people group out there that, to which the normal rules don't apply.
Right.
But they're multidimensional people. They have wives and families, and they go to church, and they go out to dinner. And
Little league practices and stuff.
And one hand, but yet on the other hand, they don't follow the rules. They do what they want.
Yeah. That is fascinating.
All of us have a little itch to be like that.
That is fascinating. That's true.
Not have the regular rules applied to it. I know I do. I'm just scared to break them.
Yes. Gary, this has been a fascinating conversation. Where can people find you, your show, your movie, all of that? Where are they? On Twitter. Tell them all that information.
Well, Ed, it's been a pleasure to be here. My website is www.ganglandwire.com. The podcast, we've got almost 100 episodes out now.
Awesome.
Is Gang, and it's on iTunes or Stitcher and all the normal places. Just type in there, Gangland Wire.
Okay.
That didn't do it. Type Gangland Wire crime stories, but I think Gangland Wire will do it.
Okay.
And that's pretty much it. I got
What about Twitter? Where are you on Twitter? What's your Twitter?
At Jenks Law. At Jenks Law.
JenksLaw. Okay. We're going to link to all of those when this show gets posted. Awesome, and you have a movie too. What's it called again?
It's a movie, Gangland Wire.
Okay,
Gangland Wire. It's on Amazon. I've got a book coming out. We're going to call it Leaving Vegas. And it's going to be just about the wiretaps and what was in the wiretaps and the interpretation of them. I'm just finishing that up now. So
is that going to be sometime in 2017? You think?
Yeah, it's pretty well done now.
Okay,
matter of fact,
great.
I'm going out to Las Vegas in January. Second Tuesday in January, I think it's the 10th, I'll be at the Clark County Library doing a talk on this particular subject.
Awesome. Love it. Going back to my town, Las Vegas. I love it. If the listeners don't know, I used to live in Las Vegas. I lived there for 13 and a half years. Love that city. Gary, once again, thank you for being on the show. His show is called Gangland Wire. Find it on iTunes. It's a great show. Gary, thank you for being on Unfound.
Thank you.
And that was Gary Jenkins from the show Gangland Wire. I deeply appreciate him joining me on the show. I can only imagine if you were able to have a 3-hour, 4-hour, 5-hour talk with him, all of the stories that he could tell about dealing with the mob, and not just that, but just being a cop for all those years. So I really enjoyed talking to him, and of course, like with all my interviews, I talk to the person beforehand before we do an official interview, and Gary is a really good guy. regarding the interview and just the general topic of the mob, I have to tell you, I think about this every time I watch something about the mafia or read a story or hear something, whatever the case may be, whether it's actually factual or fiction like The Sopranos. It sure does seem like a lot of work to be part of that group. I know, like Gary said late in the interview about, you know, there's certain fascination with it because people wonder what it would be like to just be able to push people around and make people disappear as part of business and all of that. There's a certain fascination, unfortunately, in human nature that lusts for power. It's just the way it is. And then to actually see some people who otherwise are everyday people going to their kids' Little League games otherwise, but then behind the scenes are just violent and get their way most of the time. There's a fascination with that. But on the other hand, and maybe this goes along with the kind of person that I am, that man, it looks like a lot of work. Yeah, these guys get to be feared in their neighborhoods and push people around and make all this cash without having to turn it into the IRS, on and on and on. But it also seems like they always have to be watching their own backs, and they never know when they're going to get invited somewhere, and it's a setup. I don't know if I could live that way, no matter how much power I personally had and how much people feared me. I don't think I could live like that. And it may be the reason that so many children of mafia guys end up becoming doctors, lawyers, and they go into totally different walks of life other than being in organized crime. I wonder about that. And maybe the two cases that we talked about are perfect representations of that. Do you really want to live a life where the improper disposal of a jewelry case gets you whacked? I don't know if I want to live that kind of life. No matter what else, all the other benefits that I'm getting in my life, it's pretty clear to me that in Jimmy Toll's case, that was the final straw for the rest of the gang that he was involved in. And then in Sal Manzo's case, once again, got a lot of benefits being connected to organized crime. But once again, he got set up, it seems, and they left his clothes behind. But I'm sure that his body will never be found. But as I stated before the interview, I wanted to make sure that we can all learn some things from the stories that Gary told, from how the mob handles murders and disappearances, and try to extrapolate that out to the cases that we all take an interest in, which are mainly not mafia related. They are one individual taking advantage of another. And I think a lot of parallels can be made. And it may help us as we continue to look at cases, investigate cases. And I can think of, actually, and I'm going to mention them here in a second, some cases that I'm studying right now for future episodes of Unfound, where a lot of what Gary mentions, I see in those cases. And these cases, once again, have nothing to do with organized crime. First of all, I thought a great point that was made during our Jimmy Hoffa discussion is the main reason that the mob makes most of these guys disappear is because it cuts down on an investigation. This is going to be a prime topic in a couple weeks when I talk to the nobody guy, Tad DeBias. We talk about that. And that should be clear for all of the cases that are covered on this show, is the main reason that these bodies are not found is because it's harder to prosecute. It just is. And that's why I happen to believe in a lot of these disappearances that I will cover and what all these other true crime shows cover. Most of them are pre-planned, that there is already a plan in place for what happens when the murder happens, that the murderer is going to do this and do that. And so the body is never found in this murder. Murderer can continue on his or her own life. All right, so we need to keep that in mind, that bodies don't disappear by accident. They're gone on purpose. The second point I want to make about what we heard was a point that Gary made about how the mob goes about making these guys disappear. In that, how do they lure them to a certain place where the murder can happen so no witnesses see it? I can tell you right now, I'm looking at a case, I'm studying a case, and figuring out whether I'm going to cover it on an episode of the show, where a guy was lured to a location. And I don't want to give too much away, but it's obvious that this guy was lured somewhere because of something that he was going to get. It's very obvious to me, and it's obvious to the person who is keeping this disappearance case alive, and I don't want to say too much more than that. So for all of you who take an interest in these cases, we need to figure out, did this person get lured somewhere? Was it just happenstance? Was it just circumstances? Was it just coincidence? Or did some sort of luring to a location occur? As a corollary to that, for any of you women out there who listen to this show, and I know there's, I would have to say that a majority of my audience are female. And I'm fascinated and I love that. All of you should be very wary about meeting ex-husbands, ex-boyfriends in private locations. I can't tell you how many cases I run into, specifically on charlieproject.org, where it says, the woman was last seen with her ex-husband. The ex-husband said that she left in her car and she was never seen again. It is terrifying how many kinds of stories are like that. And this is specifically for women who are meeting, once again, a lover, a boyfriend, an ex-boyfriend. If you are suspicious, if you fear him in some way, never underestimate what that guy can do. He wants to meet you, you meet him at Starbucks. He wants to meet you, you meet him in a Walmart, in the clothing section or something like that. I'm being serious. If he says, oh, just come over to the house, it's no big deal, let bygones be bygones, don't do it. Because as soon as you let your guard down, that's when something bad can happen. Just like Jimmy Tolles and Sal Manzo, I'm sure, let their guards down, thinking that nothing could happen to them. Well, something did. My third point, and what I think I learned about listening to Gary and his expertise on mob disappearances, is that we, as we continue to look at, once again, as individual cases, not mob-related, that we have to be open to the idea that a person might have been lured to a location by a friend who didn't necessarily murder the person, but assisted in the disappearance. I think that's what Gary was trying to say, once again, with the cases, these couple cases that he talked about in his interview. That if we find out while we're looking at a case that a guy went somewhere because a friend, told him to, but then the friend has an alibi for what happened when the disappearance happened, it very well could be that that friend is part of the crime. It's just hard to connect it all together. So never underestimate, we should never underestimate the function that trusted people of the person who disappeared might have actually had a hand in it. Not actually pulled the trigger or used the knife or strangled the person, but as kind of an assistant assisted in the disappearance, even though that friend may not have actually committed the murder. We always have to be open to that. And I can think of some cases that I've once again read over the last few months where that could have been the case. In fact, I will be honest that a case that pops into mind is one that I've already covered, and that was the disappearance of Donnie Smatlack. He was supposed to go see a friend of his. He disappears. The friend he was going to see did not have a criminal record. In fact, I can tell you that I've kind of looked into the guy, and he seemed to have lived a pretty decent life since then. Doesn't look seem like a killer to me, but it very well could be that he inadvertently lured Donnie somewhere where other people made Donnie disappear. We have to be open to that. And number four, as we all continue to look at missing persons cases, we have to just in general wonder if that person let their guard down. Not just in the way that they got lured somewhere, but maybe just at home. Maybe just not taking care of their business. They might have known that they were in a dangerous relationship or somebody was after them, but they left a door unlocked. Or they were trying to hide out from somebody, but then, you know, they called their mother and the mother ended up passing along the information and somebody was able to track somebody down. When I think of all this, I have to tell you, I think mostly of women who, once again, are being stalked by whoever, by a stranger or an ex-husband, whatever the case may be. Obviously, a lot of men disappear as well, whether it's regarding organized crime or not. But when I start thinking about these situations, hey, men can be lured too. That happens a lot. Once again, I just talked about Donnie Smatlack. But with women as well, if you are at home and you think that you're secure inside those four walls and you have your dog there, that doesn't necessarily mean that you can let your guard down. Just because somebody comes to knock at your door and they have some official uniform on, there's plenty of cases out there with men pretending to be cops. Many. So once again, never let your guard down. We have to keep that in mind as we look at these cases. Is it possible that this person opened themselves up to being disappeared because they just didn't dot all their I's and cross all their T's? So I thought those were some of the major points. Maybe you see even more contained within this interview with Gary Jenkins. But I think that interviews like this are going to make us all better investigators, better researchers, better reporters, maybe allow us to look between the lines a little bit more than we already have the ability to do, given all of us are amateurs. But the more we can learn from experts and people with experience like Gary Jenkins, that's going to make us better at being helpful to these people who are on my show, or even if they're not on my show, able to help them in trying to find out what happened to their loved ones. That's all I have for you for this week. I remind you to find me on Twitter, Unfound Podcast. Email me, unfoundpodcast@gmail.com. Come and join the conversation at my Facebook discussion group. Of course, the Unfound discussion group. And finally, you can find the show on Podomatic and iTunes. I'm Ed Densel, and you have been listening to Unfound. Thank you.